Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Janine, and you're listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Talk Radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media Project. You can join our team at www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer. Let us know you want to be the media. Okay, everybody. It is day 6 of being semi-snowed in here in the foothills of the Oregon Coast Range. I got a little cabin fever going on here. The freezing rain is about to start falling, so I'm glad this show comes to you from the toasty warm home office. So how about you, Debbie Lynn? How goes it in Portlandia?
Well, we're not snowed in here, but it's certainly been cold ever since I got back from California last week. And we're keeping the heat turned on and waiting for some wood to put in the fireplace, and then it'll be much nicer.
Ah, excellent. Most excellent. So I have to tell you, because, you know, you live in Portlandia and all, some of our listeners, I'm sure, have watched the TV show Portlandia. And if you've ever watched it, you've probably seen the chicken episode. It's like a viral episode. But I have to tell you, I am proud to report that on Thanksgiving of this year, we served a free-range turkey born and raised 5 miles on a farm 5 miles from my house. His name was Tommy 27. His parents were Fred and Ethel. I'm not kidding you. And he paid the ultimate sacrifice on November 22nd, 2013. So we all gave thanks for Tommy. And if that's not an Oregon experience, I don't know what is.
Oh, that one needs to be written up and sent into Portlandia, I swear. That is too funny.
Yes,
and
but
yes,
it's
thank
true.
You. And we are somewhat crazy up here, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The Pacific Northwest, definitely a unique place. So let's get down to business, shall we? Today, we continue a conversation on transpartisanship that we started a few weeks ago, that Press One for Democracy picked up and carried the ball with, and now here we are again for Transpartisan Nation Part Two. One thing is for sure. Transpartisan thinking and action are habits that we have to develop through committed practice. It's like refining any art. So here we are in the transpartisan dojo coming at this question again. Debbie Lynn, you shared an amazing fable about this kind of thinking, and we shared it in the blog, but can we take a minute? Would you read it now?
Sure. Yes, it's a really quick one. You know, it comes from somewhere in the Far East, and I have modified it somewhat because it's how I remember it. But there was once a man who set off from his home to change the world. And he got out in the world and he discovered that he didn't have enough power to actually change the world. So he stepped back and he decided that maybe that was too big of a goal and I'll just change my country instead. But again, he failed. So he returned home to his own community, and he decided to change his own community to have this transformation happen, to make it a better place for everyone, but he had no luck doing that either. So he returned home to change his family, and his family resisted all attempts that he made to change them. In the end, he decided that the only thing he really could do was to change himself, and he succeeded. As a result of his own transformation and change, his family was transformed, and that spilled out in his community. And as this community became a model for other communities around the country, his country was positively changed. His country shifted priorities and policies. The world was changed.
I just love that story. You know, the fable really demonstrates that there's an introspective side and an interactive side to, in our case, transpartisanship, but this kind of metamorphosis. The labels that we give each other or ourselves seem not to be enough to know each other, right? To even know the world it is that we're trying to change. And the only way that we can seem to walk out of the box controlled by the tools of the status quo, the media narrative, the talking points, the code words, et cetera, is to face the challenge that by knowing each other in order to trust each other, we first really need to trust and know ourselves. And our blog on www.coffeepartyusa.com today points to these introspective and interactive sides of this challenge. We included both an emotional scale tool, which is introspective, and the level of engagement tool, which is interactive. The kicker here is that it appears that one can only climb this ladder one step at a time. True? Not true? But you can certainly use these tools to identify where you are standing at any moment in time. And we'll probably, you know, refer back to these tools. If you haven't seen them yet, go to the blog post. It's a link from your Facebook page and a link from your, if you received an email blast from us today. At the end of the day, however, wherever you are on this path to a transpartisan lifestyle, you are just fine. You're fine the way you are. But keep exercising the muscle that will move you up the levels of the emotional scale and up the levels of engagement. Exercise gratitude when people show you that you have stumbled. Exercise humility when you dust yourself off. Apologize if you must, and stay on the path. It's my humble opinion that this republic's democracy is counting on you and me to do just that. So, today we are so lucky to have two amazing guests. Joan Blades from the Living Room Conversations, you remember her from an earlier show, and Dan Aronson, fellow Coffee Party board member, host of Coffee Talk radio show, Press One for Democracy, businessman, and champion of transpartisanism. Dan's going to listen in for a few minutes while we start with Joan, but welcome to the show to both of you. Debbie Lynn, can you do us the honors of introducing Joan Blades?
Sure. I recently had the privilege of having dinner with Joan and her husband, Wes, and I found out a couple of interesting things that I didn't know before, that Joan and Wes were the originators of a computer trivia game called You Don't Know Jack, and a lot of people seem to remember that trivia game, and also the Flying Toaster Screensavers. So this is...
Oh, no!
I know. It was great fun. And then they started this little political petition during the Clinton Lewinsky drama that received broad support from across the political spectrum. Their petition was a simple line that said, censure the president and move on. So this transpartisan petition drive later evolved very quickly into moveon.org, which is known as a progressive activist group. Joan has since then written several books, co-authoring the latest two, Customs at Workplace and the Motherhood Manifesto. And in her spare time, she also co-founded MomsRising.org and LivingRoomConversations.org, where I'm proud to work with her. So, Joan, welcome back to Lunch with Loudon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is an exciting day. And go ahead.
You're on, Janine. We didn't talk about who was going to ask questions of Joan.
Oh, no. I was just going to make a comment, and you're going to start with that question, so thanks very much. And I was just going to mention that I'm going to open Dan's mic and so he can chime in if need be. But and so welcome to Lunch with Loudon for you, Dan.
Thank you very much. Very excited to be here. It is my favorite topic these days.
Ah, mine too. So for both of you, we started out with a list of questions, and Debbie Lynn's going to, as a way, sort of an icebreaker for our callers. And Debbie Lynn, you're going to start by asking Joan questions.
Okay, here we go. So the first one that we had for you, Joan, was just how did you come to be transpartisan?
That's true. And I realized that I'd never thought that I am transpartisan, but as I think about your definition, I suspect I am, because, I mean, fundamentally, I believe that we need to be respectfully listening to each other and looking for common ground and opportunities to collaborate. And I've seen too much dysfunction in the last 15 years and really have seen that with citizens. They're smart, they're caring, and that's across partisan lines. And we need to take back the reins of what's going on and allow that to predominate in our political world and media world instead of the partisan fight, which is what's currently dominating.
Do you think that that some of your maybe early work in mediation kind of led you to this when you're listening respectfully?
Definitely having a background in mediation has always told me that you get dramatically better outcomes when people do collaborative problem solving. And my dream is that we rediscover how to do collaborative problem solving on a national level, because I think it's pretty clear to everyone that our current methods in D.C. are not working around the budget or around health care. You know, we could do so much better.
We could. I'm with you on that one. Would you mind sharing with us some of the highlights of the transpartisan work that you've seen or participated in?
Well, I had the privilege of being part of the early Reuniting America conversations where grassroots leaders were brought together. So I got to sit down with people like Grover Norquist and Roberta Combs and Michelle Combs of the Christian Coalition and really come to appreciate them as, you know, individuals, and to find that we do have common ground. There's some things that we definitely disagree about, but there's an awful lot of common ground in many areas. So as a mediator, I know that the thing to do is start with the common ground and build relationship, and then the tougher stuff becomes far more possible to address.
It does.
Well, ultimately, I really believe, this is Janine sort of chiming in here, I really do believe that relationship is what gets blocked by talking points and code words, and, you know, it, like, creates some kind of wall between us that keep us from actually knowing each other. You know, we don't actually know that other person as long as all we get is, like, you know, it reminds me of, you know, the old sunglasses that the skiers would wear that had mirrors on the outside. You know, it's like there was no seeing those eyes. There was no knowing who was behind there. And I really feel like what you said, that, you know, it's good to find common ground, but then once that common ground empowers relationship, and relationship is what empowers some next step of problem solving or actually being even able to broach the subject that we might both agree is an issue. And relationship is one of, I think, the ultimate consequences or outcomes of transpartisanship that is possible.
Yeah. I think the living room conversations are structured in such a way that the first hour is really dedicated to discovering that you really like the people you're sitting down with, so that by the time you get to the issue that you've chosen together, you're listening in a completely different way, because you listen to people you care about in a very caring way.
Yeah, I agree completely. So, Demi Lynn, we have a few more questions.
I do. Jonas, have you noticed any common traits of people who work in this, what we're calling the transpartisan way?
Common traits. Respectful listening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the core common trait.
And there's not a lot of that going on in the media, of course, right now, in our examples are spam.
Unfortunately.
So, is there anything else besides, is it just respectful? I mean, could we just say respectful listening and be done with it there? Or are there other traits that might be common among us?
You know, I don't feel like I'm an expert, honestly.
Okay.
You know, I don't divide people that much, which maybe is why I'm where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah,
here's a little interesting piece of trivia is today we, of course, promoted this show on the Join the Coffee Party Movement Facebook page, Lunch with Loudon Facebook page, and ironically, I probably hid more comments today than I have in months because there's something about the notion that listening to each other and finding common ground, you know, the whole transpartisan thing, brings out some kind of anger in people where they call each other names or that, you know what I'm saying? And so it's so ironic to me that a post on transpartisanship would, I've blocked like 8 posts today. I hide them. And it's just because they're calling people names or doing denigrating things. Wow. You know, if they were reading, listening, looking for, you know, what is this inquiry? I don't think that that would happen. So there's something even polarizing about this term or this idea.
Yeah, it feels like people are frightened.
And the idea of listening to each other is frightening, do you think?
I think it is. I think people don't like changing their beliefs. Change is threatening to people.
I would add to, you know, if we start like developing traits, you know, that people can work on for themselves, that respectful listening is one of them, but perhaps even some element of open-mindedness might be part of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, Dan, do you want to weigh in on this one?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Did you want to weigh in on this one? What is threatening about change, or how is this whole notion of transpartisan, why would that bring out particularly strong comments from people?
I think it's a cultural change that has swept over this country since, I always put it at the 80s, right, when the go-go 80s, when the goals changed, I think, for most people. It became all about how can I get the most for me, and once you do that, now it's me against the world. And so what happens is, you know, I think the latest effect I've seen in it, I call it the MMA effect. So, you know, when people, we used to, you know, everybody loves gladiators, right? So we used to have boxers. They were our gladiators. Two guys get in the ring and punch each other in the face until one of them drops to the ground. That used to be good enough. And you very rarely saw anything violent, I mean like death or serious injury happening in a boxing match. Now we have mixed martial arts, and we have two guys go into a cage, and most of those matches end with either somebody dropping to the ground with a very brutal injury, or their guy gets him in a hold so that he's putting him in so much pain that they have to tap out. We have escalated confrontation to an art form in this country, and violence and violent confrontation has become almost the default. And I read ahead in your question, so you said, what would I say to those people? How's that working out for you? How much progress have we seen in Washington, D.C. over the last 20 years? What has really gotten done that benefits the majority of Americans? Lord knows that since our current president took office 5 years ago, virtually nothing's been done. The one big thing that was done was the ACA, and now look at that. We're still fighting over it. So how's that working out for you? That's what I'd say.
So, Joan, do you see this kind of, is this a place where people begin in living room conversations? I mean, you talk about spending the first hour in being able to create relationship. Do people come in with this kind of polarization or this kind of angst in the beginning?
Every living room conversation is different. And living room conversations happen when two friends with different viewpoints each invite two friends to a conversation about a given topic area. So the conversation I had that got the most attention was a conversation I co-hosted with Mark Meckler, who's co-founder of Tea Party Patriots. And, you know, I think we all came into the room with some anxiousness because we have some very, very different viewpoints on many things. And we, because Mark and I like each other, we decided to start with an area where we thought we'd find quite a bit of common ground. We decided we'd talk about crony capitalism. And we had an incredibly successful conversation about that. But it's, you know, the setup for living room conversations, and I think for good conversations, is to start with something where you're very intentional about creating relationship to start with, and probably not trying to start with the most contentious thing on the list, but with something where you think you will find common ground.
So you're trying not to kick the hornet's nest, huh, to start with?
Yeah, not to start with the hornet's nest. The hornet's nest is there, and we all know about that. That's not the interesting. That's not the interesting part. The interesting part
exactly.
is finding the relationship and finding the common ground. And you know, now there's the hornet's nest that Mark and I have. You know, we come up to and we talk about it some. And sometimes, like this budget deal has, you know, created some discomfort between us because we're living in parallel realities. And I really understand that after my conversation with Mark. I realized that I could not sit down and have a similar conversation with him and his friends about fracking because what my experts have told me and what his experts have told him are so different that if I believed what he believed, I'd think fracking was a great thing. And if he believed what I believe, he'd think it's a disaster. So there's something very deeply disrespectful about the fact that local communities can't even have a conversation, a respectful conversation if they want to, because they don't have facts that empower them to do so. And this means that money and power are the dynamics that are making the choice, not informed citizens. And, you know, fracking is a process that deeply impacts local communities, giving them the capacity to have this conversation, I think, is really important.
I couldn't agree more. Part of what you said that was so amazing is if you have no facts, there's no empowered conversation. And I really think, again, that it's like having created a moat, you know, and, mm-hmm. and crossing that moat can be almost impossible because there's a place where intellectually or ideologically, there's just, you can't get there from here. And, but I am convinced, and this is particularly ironic in budget because philosophically, you know, everybody says, that Congress isn't managing our money or that Congress is failing us in these conversations. So we have this common ground that our elected, those we elect, are ineffective. And yet when it comes to why or what the answer is, there's a huge disparate perspective. And I think these are conversations we're trying to have, but what you just pointed to is kind of the how until we really refine these muscles, the muscle of transpartisanship, we're just stepping on each other, trying to have this conversation.
Yeah. Well, one of the fascinating things is Mark and I have actually started doing research because if we could bring trusted experts on both sides together to answer a set of health and safety questions that we put together, and that would be a facilitated process. And, you know, maybe we would get four of the questions answered and four of the questions we'd have this is what this group believes and this is what this group believes. But then we'd ask for a process whereby they would come up with a common answer because we don't have all the answers, and that's okay. But I can't tell you how hard it is to try and create common answers. We have not succeeded yet. I don't know if we will.
So can I chime in on that one, on that point?
Yes, I was just going to invite you.
Okay, thank you. So First of all, yeah, facts are, I mean, I don't mean to get too rudimentary, but I mean, facts are things that are provable and knowable, and a lot of what happens in the discourse on many issues, especially budget, and or even just strategy for improving our economy, are not based on facts. They're based on theories. They're based on models, right? And for every one model you can create that proves, quote unquote, proves, or at least if you extrapolate it out, you'll say I'm going to be successful. That says one thing is right, the other thing is right, and the one I always go to is the big government versus small government, right? And if or heavier taxes or less taxes, because that seems to be what the budget debates and the economic debates always revolve around. And here's my question. Forget trying to figure out which is right and which is wrong. If you are talking to someone who believes that smaller government will improve the economy, and they have their model to prove that, well, it's all theory, right? The question is, why even go there? Do you really think that you're going to be able to change their mind?
No.
They believe that they're quoting facts. And anybody who believes that they're quoting facts, even if they say the sun's going to rise tomorrow in the West, you're probably not going to be successful changing their mind. And so I think that's one of the cases where we have to be very careful, because it sets up, if you challenge their facts in the wrong way, then I think you're instantly in for a fight. And if you can't, right, and then it's like, I mean, you're exactly right, Jeanine. It's like I'm speaking, you know, Japanese and you're speaking English. If we don't have a commonality, then there's no way to have a good conversation.
Well, and this goes back and points to what Joan was talking about, with starting with things where we already know we have some common ground and building a relationship.
Which is one of my favorite points and topics, right? So you can go back and easily find 6 or 7 major issues where all the polls indicate that a vast majority of Americans agree on. There's plenty of those topics to discuss. 80% of all Americans hate the Citizens United decision and think we need to do something about it. 92% of all Americans wanted the Senate to pass mandatory background checks on gun purchases. 70 to 80% of Americans agree that we need to raise the minimum wage. There are so many good ones that if we start with those and we can work through those, not only will we get, you know, people will get excited when we make progress, right? But then we'll also establish how we work with our political opposites, and we'll have shown that you can work with your political opposites and we can make progress for the country. So there are plenty of those issues out there.
And I'm a strong supporter of working on those issues. Though I think it's a really good point you also made about economic theory. There are economic theories where you're right, it's really complex, and that's a place where I think we want to go once we have a relationship and we really listen to each other and to narrow things. I also think there are things like fracking where there are actual facts that we need to, you know, insist upon getting our experts together and giving us a real, there are health and safety issues, and we do need to have higher expectations when it comes to being empowered with good information.
But here's my challenge with quote-unquote good information. I think it's really, it's all, what's the old saying, if you don't know where you stand, you can fall for anything. Mm-hmm. And what I most often see is that whether it's economic theory, whether it's scientific facts, whether it's polls, even recognized polls, Dan, what I see is people cherry pick data to fit where they think they stand. And the interesting thing about that is where you actually stand is usually not about the issue at all, right? So you can have a position about, let's try to think of something that's not terribly shocking, but I guess fundamentally what I'm trying to say is this. I believe in human dignity. I believe in the right to make choices. I believe, you know, I have some firm fundamental beliefs from which all the rest of what I think, know, hear, see is interpreted. And because I have taken the time to sort of get who I am, then when I hear an economic theory, I can actually stand where our, you know, where I am about the dignity of humanity and the rights, responsibilities we have to one another. And then I can interpret this information from that grounded place. And I can say, oh, but what? There's missing facts here that we need to know. I don't even have to know what they are, but you can see that they're not there if you're trying to interpret what you hear from a grounded stance or, you know, sort of a self-examined place. I can be swept away with the best of them if you bring me a subject in such a way that I'm not standing anymore. I'm free flow in this information stream, right? And getting my feet back on the ground in order to interpret that information stream is the hard part. And to me, it's like the beauty of attempting a transpartisan lifestyle is I demand of myself that my feet be on the ground in order to interpret anything I hear. And that's probably a lot of words and sounding a little airy-fairy, and I'm curious if I'm making any sense to you, Joan, or to you, Dan.
You make all
ladies
kinds
first, Joan.
You make all kinds of sense. There's, I think when you have friends across partisan lines, you find that there are different ways of looking at things, and smart people can see things very differently. Smart and caring people can see things very differently. And I just, you know, I am frustrated by the media and leadership that, you know, there are things that are theories about finances, but there are also things like facts that we should know. And when there are facts and we are not making them common knowledge and we have separate facts. Yeah, in Iraq, either weapons of mass destruction were found or they were not. There can't be two sets of facts on that. And there are places where water is in danger or is not. So I think I'm pretty passionate about also when there are facts, making them so that we can all agree that this is what we're working with.
So can I ask you a question then, Joan?
Yes.
So let's talk about your web. Maybe we can do a living room conversation here. And I'll pretend to be the devil's advocate on to your point, right? So you make a point that weapons of mass destruction were not found in Iraq. What do you say to me when I say to you, so what? The inspections were put off and put off and put off. They had plenty of time to move their weapons of mass destructions to Syria or someplace else. So they were there. They just were clever enough to move them before the inspectors got there.
I can't argue with that. If they were moved, they were moved. All I can say is there is no official data that they were found. That's the only fact there. That is a fact. Now, whether they
absolutely,
been
absolutely.
Moved,
and what I'm espousing is a belief, and I think that's where the conversation usually goes awry. When you're talking to somebody who is they're arguing a belief,
mm-hmm.
Right? I can't prove they were there, but I know they were. And isn't you know
and that
and
you
that,
can't
that,
argue with.
Yeah, and that
say,
those are the
okay,
people that you run
that,
into.
I hear that's what you believe, and that's not what I believe, but I hear you.
Right.
There's
well, my comment to that. Go ahead.
Okay, we're all jumping in here at the same time now. Debbie Landak here again, and I wonder, when you had the initial design for Living Room Conversations, Joan, my sense is that it wasn't really set up to be a debate.
No, not at all.
Can you talk a little bit more about the tone of how they go?
It's set up to be a listen. It's a big listen. There's about, it's a set of 6 ground rules that are very simple and straightforward about being respectful and taking turns and being open, and taking responsibility for the conversation. And it's in a living room or some other personal space that people have agreed upon because it's being friends and friends of friends, you're relying on our social norms of hospitality. So we only expect for people to get to know each other in a first conversation and maybe find some common ground. And once you've said what you have to say about whatever the issue at hand is, then the question is, did you learn anything? Do you see anything differently? It's more reflection on, has this had any impact on you? Because people aren't going to change deep beliefs in a single conversation, but they may hear something new. And they may find that they like people they didn't expect. They would find relationships with people they didn't really realize they had a lot of common ground with. And so it's a first step. And that's actually a glorious first step. I think that's wonderful when people go there.
Well, go ahead.
Your turn, Janine.
Oh, well, I was just going to say the other thing I find in this belief to fact kind of continuum is that as long as I am able to insert my experience, right,
mm-hmm.
It's not really, my experience is not up to debate, but
mm-hmm.
my experience is my authentic representation of how these theories or how these facts might have played out in my world. And to me, that's one of the biggest tools to sort of bring it back from a moment of impasse. It's like, okay, so when it comes to, I have a business background, I have a science background, I have a lot of life experience. And if I can share with people authentically how that thinking has fit into my world and then ask the question, what was your experience with this? And try to bring it back to away from the controlled, the media narrative or the talking points or the code words, to like, what was your experience with this? I mean, you talk about weapons of mass destruction. I remember sitting there thinking, cartoons. We're using cartoons to make the decision about going to war. I mean, that's not a belief. That's a question. Why are we relying on cartoons when we're the biggest intel organization on the planet? And so I could share that experience with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows? They might say, I was kind of weirded out by the cartoons myself. The little bit of, pen on board, kind of whiteboard conversation. So, and it's the same thing with economic theory, tax theory, whatever. I have personal experiences, but I have to quiet myself to the point of getting down to how does anything that's ever happened in my life relate to this? And how does this relate to, my core values or my fundamental beliefs about the world in life? And so I just want to take a second to acknowledge that we've had folks with their hands up for a while now. So, Debbie Lynn, I interrupted you, and then we're going to go to our callers to see if they can join in on this conversation.
Yeah, well, I love that we've actually taken the turn to, with a practice tool, and we started out talking about interactivity and inner reflection, and living room conversations is just kind of like the perfect tool for us to practice, being transpartisan, if you will, having that big listen so that we can find common ground. And And so, Joan, I wanted to say thanks for coming on today with Living Room Conversations. And one of the projects I really want to put forth for Coffee Party is to have a monthly, you know, have us put out a monthly Living Room Conversation topic that our Coffee Party members across the country can gather their friends and friends of friends to have these types of conversations and actually practice transpartisanship. So, Janine, if it's okay with you, I'd like to have our callers just answer the question of what living room conversation would you like to have so we can start getting some topics ready.
Great. I'll do it. I'm first going to go to area code 513, then I'm going to go to area code 620. So 513, I'm opening your mic now. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Yes, so I didn't call in to answer a question. I called in to ask one.
Well, ask and then answer.
Okay.
And this is Laura. Yes, this is Laura. Susan?
Yes, Laura.
Excellent.
Did the comments you got in the post indicate that people actually read the entire post?
I'm not sure I understood your question.
Did the comments that people made on the post that you did today about the show indicate that they even bothered to read the entire post?
Well, sometimes I can tell that people haven't. They're just reacting either to the graphic or to the lead line. But at least some of these people had obviously attempted to read the blog. So you're right about that. Lots of folks on Facebook like to just sort of be extemporaneous
in their comments. Okay, because I guess I focused more on the end part and thought, boy, you know, it is really hard to figure out how you change yourself. Because that's the part
yes.
that hit most was the end part. About the way you change the world is to first change you.
Well, especially if you're trying something new. I mean, I don't think we invented being transpartisan. I mean, Joan already said that, you know, she had no idea that she was, but it reflects her way of being, right? I think transpartisan was an attempt to give a name to something that exists, to a strategy or an approach to this kind of the shark-infested waters of politics, so to speak. And this is the name that we've agreed to, at least in Coffee Party, to describe sort of transcending political politics and trying to get to the reality for human beings, both as individuals and collectively. So
yeah,
I think
I made a comment on a post today, and I said, can we please get over the issue of skin color and move on to something a little less superficial? And then next comment on it was F-U-B-I, you know. And I thought, I wonder if that was directed at me or at something previous.
Well, here's rule number one about Facebook. Take nothing personally.
I just let myself assume that it wasn't directed at me since it didn't say my name, but whatever, you know?
So, Laura, it sounds like...
I feel that way. Wow, I feel sad for them.
So it sounds like
anyway.
Your living room conversation suggestion would have to do with
let me
issues of color or...
My living room conversation, I guess, would be could we focus on things that really matter, things that are really important instead of things that are just kind of superficial, things that really affect our everyday lives, all of us, instead of just particular groups of us. Because I've always kind of been, we're all in the same boat. Doesn't matter what age or whatever, you know, where we come from and that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, excellent. Thanks for calling. Thanks for commenting. Go write a nice comment on Join the Coffee Party Movement post so that I can take it personally and feel good about it. How's that?
Okay.
Thanks, Laura.
You're welcome, Janine.
Before I go to area code 620, I want to remind people that if you're in chat or if you're streaming and you'd like to be in on the conversation, the number is 646-929-2495. I'm now opening up 620. I believe this is our friend Jack. Welcome to Lunch
hey.
With Loudon.
Okay, finally. Okay. Now, yesterday, I'm calling friends to see how they're interested in politics. And I had one, the thing is, good conversation is, now I, she said, okay, well, I'm an independent, okay?
Uh-huh.
And she said, no, now she was a Democrat. And I say, well, if you're not a Democrat, if you're an independent, you might as well be a Republican. It's a two-party system. That is a good discussion. Is that a necessary thing? Is that the only alternative for American politics? I say no.
Well, it is the system now, and I just stepped over somebody, so speak up.
Hey, Lynn here. And so, Jack, so your conversation would be asking the question, does the two-party system serve us
Is it necessary? Is that
is
the only alternative?
Okay.
Can't we have other parties like European countries do? Take Germany, Britain, maybe I don't know about Japan and that, but that's the way it's got to be.
Well, I'm betting that Dan would be happy to help me.
I'll go back about back to 1985 when the Bears won the Super Bowl. The guy was telling me, "Well, your two parties." If you're not for the two-party system, you're un-American.
Well, we don't agree, do we, Jack? And I bet Dan doesn't agree either. Let's have Dan step up and answer this one for you, Jack.
That's a softball, right? So I would ask that person who said that, Jack, where in the Constitution are parties even mentioned?
Yeah, the
it is a total fabrication of people who are seeking to control other people and to control the resources of the federal government, which we know are vast. That's what parties exist to do. It's for a small amount of people to control a very large number of people and their wealth.
That's the thing. That's the thing. Okay. I had, all right, yesterday it was a good development to get the Volcker Rule. Other words, the banks are not going to be the extreme control over, that hurt the banks. Big banks, six of them. Bank of America being one and Chase Manhattan, the two Chase things, fourth one would be Wells Fargo. Now, I'd say we need to, and another thing is, people who are either or thinking. You got that? Are you listening?
Yep.
Either
we got
or
about one
thinking,
more minute, Jack.
Yeah, there's another thing. Either or thinking is stinking thinking. Yeah.
Well, excellent.
That is what the Tea Party. Well, most Republicans are, and some Democrats too, are in that that may have switched.
Yeah, well,
a good topic two topics would be what divides us. Now, what's the divider and what's the uniter? How we had, what's his name? Yeah.
Having your conversations with a little while, Jack, I have to say that we always start with what we have in common. And so having that conversation about what divides us would actually set up, would make it really difficult to maintain the relationship. So coming back to the uniters, what unites us, I think that's a great question to have and to ask as a living room conversation along with the two-party system.
Yeah, I agree totally. And thank you so much for that, Jack. So we're coming close to the end of our hour. And I know that there are things that we could resolve together, and there are things that we need to move forward with in terms of where do we go from here? Do we see transpartisan, that transpartisan muscle is something that you need to sort of have this I'm in training mentality. And certainly in living room conversations and the ones that we suggested on talk shows like this and on the pages, we have the opportunity to sort of discuss this. I see that we have dropped Joan. So thank you so much for joining us, Joan. I'm sure you'll be back soon, and we'll be talking coffee party living room conversations soon. Dan, where has this conversation left you, and where would you like to go from here?
I would like, if you don't mind, to finish with a pitch for transpartisanship or transpartisanism, whichever is the proper word. And that is this, and it goes back actually to your first question about how did I become transpartisan, right? When did I become transpartisan? So I was always in one camp or the other, albeit issue-based, and I only saw it from that myopic view. Everything was seen from that myopic view, and I always looked at anybody who had a different opinion as, you know, oh, you're silly. Oh, just go away. Leave me alone. But here's why transpartisanship must succeed. And I didn't get it until I was able to go up and look at it from the very highest elevation and look down on the system as it exists and see that sneaky third group of people, right? And that leads us to the coffee party's main mission, right? So while we have two groups, almost 50% of the population warring against each other, this third group is scurrying all around, the third group called big money, and they're making sure that it really doesn't matter what the outcome of our discussions are, because the people in Washington are only listening to those people with big money. And therefore, we can sit here and war all day about fracking, about weapons of mass destruction, about the economy, about the budget. We can sit here and talk all day. If we don't have enough money in our checkbook to write a big enough check to a congressman or a senator, they don't care. They're not doing what we want them to do. If for no other reason than the need to trump and destroy the influence of big money in Washington, D.C., we need transpartisanship to succeed so we can band together the 98% to fight against the influence of the 2% with the only thing we have at our disposal, which is our vote. That's why transpartisanship must succeed. That is all.
Well, I totally agree with your rant, Dan, and the reason I agree is if talking to one another wasn't dangerous to the invisible third party, right? If it wasn't dangerous, I don't think that they would work so hard to keep us apart. You know, it's kind of like the voting. People say voting doesn't matter, and my answer is, well, if it doesn't matter, why are people working so hard to keep you from voting?
Right.
Like, to me, it's like it's the proof that you're on to something, or at least something that you need. You know, this dog's ready to hunt that one, because, you know, what happens when people talk to each other? And you've probably heard me say this before, but I am such a believer in this mystic and magical thing called American ingenuity. And I really think when people come at problems from different perspective and different points of view, what we end up with is some kind of spark that creates an answer that no one anticipated. Nobody came to the conversation with the answer. They brought themselves to the conversation, and this thing was born. The solution was born. And so, you know, if, you know, the third party stays powerful by being invisible, conversation will expose it. Conversation does expose it. But we have to create that safe place where we acknowledge no one is always right, no one is always wrong, that evidence based on facts and data is more powerful than simple beliefs, but beliefs need to be acknowledged. You know, if you just acknowledge, I know that's how you feel, and here was my experience, then it's actually possible to start, you know, the avalanche, so to speak. You know, avalanches start, you know, with one pine cone falling off a tree, but builds momentum until it's a deadly force at the bottom of the mountain. And I really feel like that's what we're trying to do with transpartisanship, is drop enough pine cones that pretty soon the way of thinking is altered, the way of viewing is altered, the way of approaching problems is altered. It's almost clandestine. But it's exactly how we got to the position now, was with this clandestine sourcing of information and building of artificial walls and creation of labels and stereotypes and the dreaded code words and all. So I've heard myself enough.
And before, well, and before we get to all of that, it goes back to the fable that we opened the show with. You know, to impact any change in the world, we first must look inside ourselves to actually be the change we want to see in the world.
Right. It's kind of like, do you want to be right or do you want to be effective? Mm-hmm. You know, do you want to be right or do you want to have things work? And but that's a, you know, that's normal.
Yeah.
That's the place you take kids from this, you know, you do it to yourself, you do it to your, you know, your pets that they need. It's a kind of a intentional maturation process, but not to say where you are is immature, but to say where you are not today. None of us are today who we hope will be. This country is not today what we hope it will be. There's an evolution. There's a growth. Find a word that doesn't offend that means tomorrow will be different than today, and rejoice in that difference. And then you know where you want to go. And I see your hand coming up again, Dan.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that philosophy has been espoused by both men of peace and men of war as critical to the process of either peace or war, change you want to see in the world. And Sun Tzu said, "Know thyself. If you know yourself, then you will win 50% of your battles." And then he said, "If you know your enemy, you'll win the other 50%." But both are critical. So no matter whether you're coming from it from a controversial approach or whether you're coming at it from a peaceful approach, both are. It's knowing yourself is critical to the process.
I couldn't agree more. It's a perfect segue to our closing. Thank you so much for being with us here today, Dan. I enjoy this conversation with you every time we have the chance to speak about it, and I know that this isn't the end of our conversation, but I look forward to fighting the good fight with you in a transpartisan way. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And so it's time to tell everybody about other Coffee Party Internet radio shows. Mondays, our friend Dan Aronson, who was just speaking, hosts Press One for Democracy at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Tuesdays, our show, The Middle Ground, is still on hiatus. Number one, I vote that we change it to The Common Ground. And number two, I vote that one of you listeners out there get a hold of us at www.coffeepartyusa.com and let us know you're interested in that radio show and maybe you'd like to be trained as a host or a co-host. We would love it. Thursdays, Lunch with Loudon, here you are, noon Pacific, 3 p.m. I guess it's Coffee Break with Loudon on the East Coast. Saturdays, Egberto Willis hosts Politics Done Right, 10 a.m. Pacific,
1 Eastern.
Coffee Party USA is a totally grassroots, crowdsourced organization. Citizens United has not benefited us. If you'd like to become a member, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com and find the big red member button. If you'd just like to donate money, the difference is, of course, you won't be voting on issues like boards of directors or topics and initiatives that the Coffee Party wants to launch. You can go find that donate button, and we are forever grateful for your contribution to us. You can follow this conversation on Lunch with Loudon Facebook page, on Join the Coffee Party Movement Facebook page, and at www.coffeepartyusa.com, check out the blogs. Thanks so much, everybody. This has been great. Coffee Party on.